All right, we're going to be in Revelation chapter 17 tonight. Revelation 17, starting in verse number 1. If you want to open your Bibles there, it was the perfect song to sing to get us in the mood for the battle that we're about to be in tonight. And, of course, to find out about our victory, because the Lamb cannot be defeated. That song says in the second verse that hell's foundations quiver with the shout of praise. And that's how it is. God wins. Jesus is victorious. And it doesn't matter what the devil tries to line up against him, how great the power, how many nations are involved, how many means and methods he uses, he will never, ever be victorious. And as long as we stay with the Lord, that victory is also ours. And that's what these chapters 17, 18, and into chapter 19 are all about. In our Bible class this morning, we were looking at Revelation 19:9, which is a beatitude, and it had to do with the victory that we have in Christ. And chapter 19 is where that victory is finally realized. But chapter 17 and 18 are the battle that bring us to that victory. So we know where it's going. We're going to see tonight how we get there, at least the first part of it, as we talk about the Lamb shall overcome. So in this section of the book of Revelation, we've been noticing, of course, that Satan is always working to fight against God's people and the church, and he uses whatever forces that he can. And so we've seen political power, we've seen false religion being used, and uniting together in the Roman Empire to become a dominating and a domineering world force to try to stop the spread of the gospel. And as this all started in this section, in chapter 12, we were introduced to that woman who fled into the wilderness because Satan was attacking. And we learned that she represented the remnant of God's people, those who were faithful to him throughout the ages, starting in the Old Testament and now in the New. She is the church, the Lord's church. And so while Rome was trying to persecute her and to get Christians to deny their faith, and if not, to kill them for their faith, we're introduced now to another woman. And this woman in chapter 17 is the direct opposite of that woman clothed in white who fled into the wilderness. This woman is a harlot, and she represents the worldly, the city slash empire that is Babylon, and in John's day was kind of, you know, brought into what is the Roman Empire. And so God has already told us that Babylon is going to fall. In fact, he said Babylon the Great is fallen, as though it were already accomplished, because to God it is. But now we're going to see how that fall begins to happen. So the first part of chapter 17, verses 1 through 6, we have the harlot identified for us. And we'll read through here and talk a little bit about it, and then going into the end of the chapter. But verse 1 says, "There came one of the seven angels which had the seven vials, and talked with me, saying unto me, Come hither, I will show unto thee the judgment of the great whore that sitteth upon many waters, with whom the kings of the earth have committed fornication, and the inhabitants of the earth have been made drunk with the wine of her fornication. So he carried me away in the spirit into the wilderness, and I saw a woman sit upon a scarlet-colored beast, full of names of blasphemy, having seven heads and ten horns. And the woman was arrayed in purple and scarlet color, and decked with gold and precious stones and pearls, having a golden cup in her hands full of abominations and filthiness of her fornication. And upon her forehead was a name written, Mystery, Babylon the Great, the mother of harlots and abominations of the earth. And I saw the woman drunken with the blood of the saints and with the blood of the martyrs of Jesus. And when I saw her, I wondered with great admiration." So we have the harlot identified in these first few verses here, which is important to recognize and understand what God is talking about and what John is talking about and how this is revealed in those symbolic terms. In Homer Haley's commentary at his kind of introduction to this chapter, he reminds us and emphasizes the three means that the devil uses to attack the church. Number one is political persecution. And that was represented by the beast from the sea, or the sea beast, which we'll talk about again. Then there was false religion, which again had become kind of nationalized in the Roman Empire with emperor worship. So if you didn't worship the emperor, then you couldn't get a job and you couldn't provide for your family. And so you had to compromise your faith in God to be able to put food on the table. And many went along with that, which is not what they were to do. But that false religion was a means of persecution and oppression of Christians. And the third means that the devil uses is the world of lust, the desire for physical, fleshly things, whether that's sensual desire or money and wealth, worldliness, pleasure, whatever it is. That's the third means that the devil uses to try to attack God's people. If he can't give them to give up their faith with the threat of death or, you know, oppression and suffering, he tries to lure them into sin through temptation. And so that's what the harlot represents. So you have this threefold attack on the church from the beast from the sea, political power, from the beast from the earth, which is false religion, and then from the harlot, which is the lust of the flesh and all that goes along with that. So we just finished reading about the seven angels pouring out seven bowls of God's wrath, indicating that the time of judgment has come. And one of those angels, and we're not told which one, and it doesn't matter, but one of them is the one who talked with John and tells him to come here. He wants to show him something. He's going to show him the judgment of the great whore, the King James Version says, a harlot or prostitute is the word. The word for judgment there is a judicial decree. So this is the pronouncement of judgment. This is the conviction for her crimes, and we're going to be told exactly who she is and why she deserves punishment. And so he is going to see this harlot, John describes, or the angel describes, as one that sits upon many waters. So we're told what that means in verse 15. It says, he saith unto me, the waters which thou sawest, where the whore sitteth, are peoples and multitudes and nations and tongues. And we'll talk about that a little more in just a few minutes when we get to that. But that's what the waters represented. And so we've already seen that in the book. When it talks about the sea or the waters, it's the sea of humanity. And so this political power, or this worldly power of the Roman Empire, comes out of the sea of humanity. It's people lusting after worldly things, and because Rome will provide it for them, they give their allegiance to Rome. And they don't care about the morality of it. All they care about is that they get what they want. And multitudes, of course, do that and have done that and continue to do that to this day. But this is a reference back to God's judgment on Babylon in the time of Jeremiah. In Jeremiah 51, verses 12 and 13, God said, set up the standard upon the walls of Babylon, make the watch strong, set up the watchmen, prepare the ambushes. For the Lord hath both devised and done that which he spake against the inhabitants of Babylon. So God says, get your watchmen out and be on guard, because I told you it's coming, and now it's here, the judgment of Babylon. Verse 13, he says, O thou that dwellest upon many waters, abundant in treasures, thine end is come, and the measure of thy covetousness. So God described Babylon as dwelling upon many waters. And that possibly had a reference to the Euphrates River, which Babylon was built on, and the many, you know, tunnels and channels and all of that that were dug and ultimately were used to defeat Babylon. But it's also reminding us of what John is seeing in Revelation. Humanity. Babylon is the world system, the world empire, and represents that. But it's described as being made up of many people, abundant in treasures. And that's one of the keys. This is materialism and the desire for physical material things. And now they're going to receive the measure of their covetousness. So they coveted after things, and now they're going to receive the end of that, the consequences of it. When you devote your life only to material things, you end up under the judgment and condemnation of God. And so they would get those material things by, you know, whatever they had to do, conquering other people with great violence and cruelty and oppressing people. Also, they would get more for themselves. Well, now they're going to reap the reward of that. And so the language used here, again, is built on and comes from that passage in the Old Testament. So the revelation of that judgment is what chapter 17 and 18 are about. In the Old Testament, there are four cities that are described as harlots. One is the city of Tyre. And I'm not going to read these passages. They're on the outline and you can read them. But from Isaiah 23, Tyre was described as a harlot. And it had to do with that principle of materialism. Tyre was an island or a coastline city, and they sent ships out everywhere, and they were known for their commerce. So they were a harlot for money. They cared about material things. Secondly was Babylon. Babylon was called a harlot in Isaiah 47, and her harlotry had to do with pleasures of the world, lust and pleasure and worldliness. So she was a harlot for worldly things. Nineveh is the third in Nahum chapter 3. And her harlotry had to do with her cruelty and her conquest of others. It was all in a desire for power. You remember that Jonah was to go to preach to the city of Nineveh. And he didn't want to because he wanted Nineveh to be destroyed because they were so cruel. And they were very cruel and very violent in the way that they treated people, and especially people that they conquered and defeated. They were just horrible to them. So their lust for power, they were harlots for power, and they didn't care what they had to do to others to get that. And then the fourth city is Jerusalem. And Jerusalem's referred to as a harlot in Isaiah 121, and then again in Jeremiah 2:20. But for Jerusalem, their harlotry had to do with religious corruption, spiritual adultery, their worshiping of idols and twisting God's religion into something that it was never intended to be. So with those four cities, you get the full picture of what it means for a city or an empire or a nation to be classified as a harlot. It has to do with materialism, worldliness, including the pleasures of the world, power, and religious corruption. And all of those things are found in Rome. So if you remember, while this idea of being a prostitute has to do with, you know, physically it's selling your body, spiritually it's selling your soul for whatever these things are that you can gain, it's also connected to that worldliness of the sensual appetites and wanting material things. So Rome, if you remember back in Daniel, was prophesied as the fourth world empire. And we were told in that prophecy that the first three empires were incorporated into the fourth. And so this picture of all these different aspects of harlotry are all found in Rome. And so she takes the wickedness of all the other world empires and brings them into herself. So Rome was the worst of all of the nations. Rome was, you know, top of the list for being the worst. So when we read about Babylon here in Revelation, we're reading about Rome. Babylon is a symbolic name for Rome because Babylon, of course, had fallen a long time ago, but Rome took up the mantle that was Babylon and then took it even further than Babylon did. So because of that kind of influence that Rome had, the power and the force that she exercised over the known world, other nations were seduced by her. And that's what verse 2 is about when it says that the kings of the earth have committed fornication with her. It means that they went along with her wickedness and corruption in order to reap the benefits of being a friend of Rome or being aligned with Rome. And so because Rome was corrupt, all those who went along with her became corrupt as well. And so they committed fornication. And again, selling their souls in the sense of not standing for morality and what is right, because they cared more about worldly things. And so it says, the inhabitants of the earth have been made drunk with the wine of her fornication. And so that phrase was introduced to us back in chapter 14 in verse 8, where it says, there followed another angel saying, Babylon is fallen, that great city, because she made all nations drink of the wine of the wrath of her fornication. And so the idea has already been introduced, and now we're seeing how that played out and what that looked like. So again, back in Jeremiah 51, where we read a moment ago in verse 7, Through Jeremiah, God said, Babylon hath been a golden cup in the Lord's hand that hath made all the earth drunken. The nations have drunken of her wine, therefore the nations are mad. And not mad angry, but mad crazy. They're intoxicated because they committed themselves to Babylon's corruption. So when you think about Babel in the Old Testament, you know, you start with the Tower of Babel, even though in a sense it kind of goes before that with Nimrod and his corruption. Babylon becomes a symbol of this kind of rejection of God for worldliness. And so anytime something becomes connected to Babylon, it has that implication to it. Well, Rome is Babylon reincarnated, if you will, and again, to even a worse degree than Babylon was. And so that's what we're being told here about this harlot and who she is. So John's been told, I'm going to tell you about this harlot who sits on the waters. Then he's taken out to the wilderness to see it. And instead of seeing a harlot sitting on waters, he sees a woman sitting on a scarlet-colored beast. And that beast is described as being full of names of blasphemy, having seven heads and 10 horns. And this ought to be familiar to us because this is the beast from the sea. Back in chapter 13 and verse 1, he said, I stood upon the sand of the sea and saw a beast rise up out of the sea having 7 heads and 10 horns, and upon his horns 10 crowns, and upon his heads the names of blasphemy. And so this is the same beast, just in a different form or presentation for the symbolism of it. Here it's colored scarlet. So this is the beast from the sea, and remember, the beast from the sea is the political persecution of Rome. Rome using its political power to try to silence Christians and to destroy the church. So scarlet was the color of royalty, along with purple that we read about in the next verse. It was the color of luxury, the color of excess. You remember that when Jesus was crucified, they stripped him and put on him a scarlet robe in Matthew 27, 28. And then verse 29 says, when they had plaited a crown of thorns, they put it on his head and a reed in his right hand, and they bowed the knee before him and mocked him, saying, Hail, King of the Jews. The scarlet robe symbolized royalty. But there, of course, for Jesus, they did it in mockery. But here you have this beast, colored scarlet, indicating that this is the appearance of it. It looks very wealthy, very luxurious, something that has power and influence. Also remember Isaiah 1 and verse 18, where Isaiah says, Come now and let us reason together, saith the Lord. Though your sins be as scarlet, they shall be white as snow. Though they be red like crimson, they shall be as wool. So scarlet, while it's the color of royalty and it's meant to present the beast as something to be desired or to want to be, you know, in allegiance with, it's also the color of sin, and it's the opposite of white, which is the clothing that the other woman wears and what the faithful wear, white garments that are purified from sin. So this color, scarlet, of the beast connects the beast to the harlot, because in the next verse we're told that she was arrayed in purple and scarlet colored. Color, and also decked with gold and precious stones and pearls, having a golden cup in her hand, full of abominations and filthiness of her fornication. So the point is that the harlot is disguising who she really is. She doesn't want you to know that she's a prostitute and you have to sell your soul to get her riches. She just wants you to see the wealth and the opulence and the beauty and the majesty of Rome. Right? And if you have to worship the emperor in order to get that, well, that's not a big deal. If you have to bow down before an idol and make obeisance to a statue, right? You just do that, and then you get all the good things that come with being a Roman and a Roman citizen. And people bought into that. And because of that, they didn't see the harlot for who she was. But God is making it known very clearly who she is here, by the symbolism that she uses, or he uses. In Proverbs chapter 9 and verse 13, this very idea was told by the wise man to his son, wisdom personified as teaching his child, to be careful of the foolish woman. And here's what he says. A foolish woman is clamorous. She is simple and knoweth nothing. For she sitteth at the door of her house, on a seat in the high places of the city to call passengers who go right on their ways. Whoso is simple, let him turn in hither. And as for him that wanteth understanding, she saith to him, stolen waters are sweet, and bread eaten in secret is pleasant. But he knoweth not that the dead are there, and that her guests are in the depths of hell. And so this foolish woman is a prostitute, or she's just a woman with very loose morals, and she sits at the door of her house calling to people that pass by to come into her. And the wise man says, if you're foolish, if you lack wisdom, you'll say, you know, this is an easy situation, a perfect situation that's been presented to me. There are no consequences, nothing bad's going to happen. And you go into her and you don't realize that you're going into the dead, that all that you'll find with her is death in the depths of hell, because there are consequences to those actions. It may seem like stolen waters are sweet, right? If you've stolen something, it tastes better than if you just, you know, it worked and bought it and paid money for it because of the, you know, the crime that went along with it. If it's another man's wife, right, it has an allure to it that maybe doesn't if it's just your wife, right? That's the principle that he's talking about here. But he says there are always consequences. It's the bait, but the devil doesn't want you to see the hook, right? That's what this picture is of the harlot. She wants you to see her beauty and her gold and her riches and all of that, but not the hook that once you bite, she's got you. And it's really not her. It's the devil, the Satan, the dragon who's behind all of this. And so that's what's being described here for us with this woman. Haley said she holds in her hand the cup of her own self-destruction as the consequences of her sins are turned back upon her, which we'll see in verse 16. So then she's finally given a name. She's identified in verse 5 as Mystery, Babylon the Great, the mother of harlots and abominations of the earth. You know, there's an idea in our world today that you hear quite often where people say, you know, I don't like labels, right? Don't label me as this or label me as that, because people don't want to be defined as something, right? But there is great importance in labels when they are true. When God says that this woman is not only a harlot, but she's the mother of all harlots, she doesn't want you to label her that way. She wants you to see her as a beautiful, wealthy, rich woman. But God tells us exactly who she is. And sometimes you have to call a spade a spade. You have to call sin, sin. And it has to be labeled that way. And people say, I don't like labels, and don't judge me, and don't try to put that on me. I'm not just an alcoholic. I'm also, you know, a good father or a good neighbor or whatever. But an alcoholic is an alcoholic, right? I'm not just an adulterer, but I'm also this and that. I'm an upstanding citizen. But adultery is adultery. It's sin, right? So these things have to be labeled and called out for what they are. Not to put people down, but to help them see their sin so they can make it right. And that's what God does here by telling us exactly who she is. She's not this beautiful woman who's going to give you riches. She is of the abominations of the earth. And so she's Babylon, Babylon the Great, which again is a symbol for Rome. And then we're told about her nature, that she is a harlot. She's the mother of harlots. And everything associated with her is abomination. It's repulsive to God, and it's against what is best for man. And when you see her for what she is, that takes away all of her seductive power, right? She may be beautiful, but if she has a disease, you're not going to mess with her, right? Sin, the devil presents it as a very beautiful, enjoyable thing that's only going to make you happy. He doesn't tell you the consequences. When you see the consequences, the sin, the temptation loses its drawing power. And that's what God has done here. He's shown us who she is so people will not be seduced by her any longer. And then he tells us that she was drunk in verse 6 with the blood of the saints. And so you look at this golden cup and you think, oh, she must be drinking, you know, the best drink, whatever it is. But when you look in the cup, it's actually full of blood. Because the thing that gives her her power and has given her this wealth is her oppression of others. And that includes killing Christians, either by martyring them or by leading them away from Christ through temptation and so forth. And so when you look behind the curtain, all you find there is blood and suffering and death. So the point is, don't have anything to do with this woman. And when John saw all of this, he says, I wondered with great admiration. That doesn't mean that he admired this woman. The word for admiration there is the word for wonder. He wondered with a great wonder. He was astonished and amazed at what he had seen. So that's the harlot identified. Then you have the beast mystified. In verse 7, the angel says to John, the angel said unto me, wherefore didst thou marvel? I will tell thee the mystery of the woman and of the beast that carrieth her, which hath the 7 heads and 10 horns. The beast that thou sawest was and is not, and shall ascend out of the bottomless pit and go into perdition. And they that dwell on the earth shall wonder, whose names were not written in the book of life from the foundation of the world, when they behold the beast that was and is not, and yet is. And here is the mind which hath wisdom. The 7 heads are 7 mountains on which the woman sitteth. And there are 7 kings. 5 are fallen, and 1 is, and the other is not yet come. And when he cometh, he must continue a short space. And the beast that was and is not, even he is the 8th, and is of the 7, and goeth into perdition. And the 10 horns which thou sawest are 10 kings, which have received no kingdom as yet, but receive power as kings 1 hour with the beast. These have 1 mind and shall give their power and strength unto the beast. So here we have the beast, and it's kind of a mystery, but the angel says, I'm going to reveal it to you. And he does reveal it to us, and he does it in symbolic terms. And these are probably the most difficult symbolisms in the book of Revelation. There's some stuff over toward chapter 20 that's kind of tough, but this part's difficult. And especially because so many people forget that it's symbolic, and they try to make these numbers literal. And so you have, if you read commentaries, you have everything from these are the Jewish people persecuting the church, before AD 70, to these are different empires going all the way back to Egypt through Babylon and Greece and so forth. And it's going to end with the kingdom of the Antichrist, who's coming at the end of time, right? Premillennialists have to get their spin in there. Then you have people who kind of avoid all that, but they start naming emperors of Rome. And the first one was this one. And depending on where you start, depends on where you end up. But it doesn't work out exactly right. So they'll say, well, this guy wasn't really an emperor. He kind of just usurped the throne. So we don't count him. And they try to arrange it. So you get Nero and Domitian and all these. And none of it works. None of it really makes sense, because these are not literal numbers about literal emperors or kingdoms as far as that goes. It's a symbolic language telling us a symbolic message. And we have to keep that in mind. And I'm going to try to do that. And I may not get it exactly right on this part, because it is difficult. But keeping it in what we've talked about, everything that's led up to this chapter, I think we can get the idea of what he's telling us here. So the power of the beast from the sea, this political power, that of course included the emperors, because the emperors are the ones who made the decrees. So we had Nero, who persecuted Christians severely, and then he died and that persecution stopped. And then after some time, the emperor Domitian came to power. And what Nero did was bad. What Domitian did was, 100 times worse. He was terrible in his persecution of Christians and the church. So the persecution was, and then it was no more, and then it is again. So it lived and it died, and then it came back from the dead, is what that is pictured as in symbolic terms. If you remember back in chapter 13, the beast of the sea, he was wounded in the head and he died, and then he was resurrected. And we talked about how that wasn't a literal resurrection, but is a resurrection of his cause, trying to destroy the church, and then it stopped, and then it came back again. And that's the same thing that he's talking about here. This power of persecution existed for a while, and then it eased for a time, and then it came back. And it always does. It'll go away and then it'll come back in another form and from another place. And so these seven nations or seven kings that are represented here simply means the completion or the perfect completion, the fullness of those nations that persecute the Lord's church. And so sometimes they do it for a while and then it stops and then it's going to come back in another way, as it has throughout history. But what we know and what this passage is telling us is that it doesn't matter who it is or when it is or what it is, we know their end. It is perdition. They come out of the abyss because they are empowered by Satan. They're doing his work, but when they come out of the abyss, they end up in perdition. Perdition is utter destruction and ruin. So they think they're going to be victorious, and they're defeated over and over and over again. It happens that way every time. So the fate of all these persecutors of Christians is set, and there's no way around it. They're going to perdition. They're headed toward that ruin and utter destruction, which ultimately is eternal punishment in hell. So a couple things here. When he mentions the seven mountains, the seven heads or seven mountains, anybody in John's day reading that would say this is Rome, because Rome was the city on seven hills. It was built on seven mountains. Everybody knew that. Everybody has known that throughout history. That's exactly what they would have thought of. And so John is tying this to Rome, but then I think he's not just limiting it to Rome. He's telling them Rome's going to be defeated, Babylon's going to fall, but this persecution may come again in another form from another place and whatever, but it's still going to be defeated because the Lamb is always going to be victorious. So notice something interesting here. He says in verse 10, there are seven kings, five are fallen and one is, and the other is not yet come, and when he cometh, he must continue a short space. And then in verse 11, he says, the beast that was and is not, even he is the eighth, and is of the seven, and goeth into perdition. Now, how can number eight be part of the seven? That's like that old thing in the pirate lore, right? They had those trinkets, the seven of eight or eight of seven. I forget how it was, but it just didn't fit. If you have seven, you don't have eight. If you have eight, you don't have seven. So he says number eight is part of the seven. Well, seven is the number of completion. So there's a complete persecution that is stopped, and then number eight comes along. He's still part of the seven, and he's still going to be defeated just like they were. He just came after them, and now he's going to face his downfall. And there may be another one after that, but he's going to be defeated also. And that's all that John is trying to tell us here. This world power domination that was happening through Rome is going to fall utterly and completely and is never going to come back, in the sense that there's not going to be a dominant world power to destroy the church. Jesus utterly defeats that. But that doesn't mean there won't be any more persecution or suffering. It won't be to the extent that Rome was, but it'll still be, you know, if you're going through it, it's bad for you, no matter what it is. And so it's an important principle to remember. It's also something that ought to encourage us on one hand and shame us on the other, because on one hand, we know that we're not going to face what they faced under Rome, and on the other hand, we don't face what they faced under Rome, and sometimes we fall short of what they did. We're not as faithful to the Lord as they were, and they had it so difficult that it puts us to shame. And so we have to learn, you know, those lessons. So there are 10 horns that also represent 10 kings. 10 is also a symbolic number. It's not meant to be taken literally, but it's a number for fullness, particularly in power or in authority. And if you notice, these 10 kings, they give their authority to the beast in verse 12, but only for 1 hour. So these are nations that come along later on in the reign of Rome, and they agree to go in with them in this war against the church, but they don't realize that the time of Rome's fall is at hand. And so they come in at the last minute and think they're going to help Rome, and they become part of its downfall and destruction. So their time is short because the downfall is near. But they are perfectly united in one mind, and that one mind is to destroy the church. So God wants his people to be of one mind and of one judgment. And that means to be focused and intently devoted to the cause of Christ. Sometimes, a lot of the time, the devil's forces are much more focused and intentioned on doing evil than we are on doing good. We think we don't really have to do anything, just, you know, sit back and don't sin. We don't have to be a force marching forward like we just sang about into this battle for good, offering our shouts of praise to make the foundations of hell quiver by preaching the gospel to the lost. Yet we're supposed to be engaging the enemy, active on the battlefield. And here's why, because of verse 14, which is, in my opinion, what the book of Revelation is all about. This is the key verse. These shall make war with the Lamb, and the Lamb shall overcome them. For he is Lord of lords and King of kings, and they that are with him are called and chosen and faithful. So no matter how many people have joined in this alliance against the Lord, no matter how many nations the harlot has seduced, no matter how much wealth and how big the army and how much military force, how much material wealth, whatever Rome has, they cannot defeat Jesus because he is King of kings and Lord of lords. The greatest king of the Roman Empire is inferior to Christ. The greatest king of Babylon or Greece or any nation on earth, Jesus is king of them. He's Lord over all the earthly lords. He's greater than all. So no matter what they do, they cannot win this fight. It's absolutely impossible. And so to the Christian who was suffering persecution, they needed to understand that these things are difficult, but you already have the victory. You're going to overcome. You get to go to heaven, and the cause of Christ is going to be victorious. And that's exactly what happened because of the power of the Lamb. And if we're faithful to him, we'll share in that victory. So here's what that looked like in verse 15. He saith unto me, the waters which thou sawest, where the horse sitteth, are peoples and multitudes and nations and tongues. So we mentioned that Rome is sitting on, this political power is sitting on all these many ethnic groups that had been conquered by the Roman Empire. The problem is that Rome conquered all of these people, but they didn't make them Roman. They were still whatever they were when they were conquered. And they went along with Rome partly because they were conquered, partly because they got some benefit out of it materially and whatever. There were benefits with Roman citizenship and all that. But deep down in their hearts, they wanted Rome to fall because they wanted to go back being who they were before the Romans took over. And so this lack of cohesion led directly to the downfall of Rome, just as God promised that it would back in that dream of Nebuchadnezzar. In Daniel 2 and 41, Daniel says, whereas thou sawest the feet and toes, part of potter's clay and part of iron, the kingdom shall be divided. But there shall be in it of the strength of the iron, for as much as thou sawest the iron mixed with miry clay. And as the toes of the feet were part of iron and part of clay, so the kingdom shall be partly strong and partly broken. And whereas thou sawest iron mixed with miry clay, they shall mingle themselves with the seed of men, but they shall not cleave one to another, even as iron is not mixed with the clay. So when a man and woman get married, husband and wife, they are to leave father and mother and cleave to one another. Here were people who are brought into the Roman Empire, but they didn't cleave to Rome. They didn't have Roman philosophy or Roman principles or any of those things. So when trouble starts brewing, they're ready to separate and go back to who they were. And that happens throughout the Roman Empire. So exactly what God said and exactly what we see here in Revelation is exactly what happened. But there's another thing. In verse 16, he says, and the 10 horns which thou sawest upon the beast, these shall hate the whore, and shall make her desolate and naked, and shall eat her flesh and burn her with fire. So the second thing that would lead to the downfall of Rome in relation to what God is talking about here is that those kingdoms that joined with Rome, when it starts falling apart, when they start reaping the consequences of their sins, they turn their allegiance into hatred. Right? We sold our souls for you, and now you can't give us what you promised. So they turned against Rome. So not only were they not joined together, you know, in this relationship as Romans, But now they take all of their suffering and they blame it on Rome. And so they become not just wanting to get away from Rome to be their own people, they want to bring it down. And again, that's what happened. And it's not the only things that caused Rome to fall, but those were two very important things. And God says that this was all his doing. He said, "For God hath put it in their hearts to fulfill his will and to agree and give their kingdom unto the beast until the words of God shall be fulfilled." So even though they didn't know it, they were doing God's will when they turned against Rome and led to its downfall. God arranged things so that it would happen this way and told us before it happened what was going to happen. One passage real quick from 2 Chronicles 20, verse 23, shows us how God does these things sometimes. It says, "For the children of Ammon and Moab stood up against the inhabitants of Mount Seir, utterly to slay and to destroy them." So you have the people of Mount Seir, you have the Ammonites and the Moabites. They join together to fight these people and defeat them, and they do. And then it says, "And when they had made an end of the inhabitants of Seir, everyone helped to destroy another." So after they defeated their enemy, the Moabites and the Ammonites turned on each other and destroyed each other. And that's God's doing, and it's also the way that evil works, right? They'll come together to defeat a common enemy, and then they turn on each other, and they turn on themselves, and they destroy themselves. And that's exactly what happened in Rome. And then finally, verse 18, "The woman which thou sawest is that great city which reigneth over the kings of the earth." And so again, she's identified the great city, Babylon. She has authority over the kings of the earth, but all that is coming to an end because God has been working on the inside to bring about the downfall of this world power. Well, chapter 18 is going to show us that fall of Babylon in relation to the other beast, the beast from the land, and again, how it ties into the harlot and the beast from the sea. And so we'll see the final fall of Babylon, of Rome here. But again, the message is for all of the symbolism and the confusion that people have over it, the message is simple. The devil is not going to stop attacking the church, but he can never defeat it. So don't give in. When he uses persecution against you, don't give in to it. When he uses political power or he comes at you with false religion, trying to get you to deny the gospel and accept an easier path, don't listen to him. When he tempts you with worldliness, don't yield to that temptation, because all of those are just bait with a hook in it, and all he wants to do is to get you, to draw you away from Christ. But if we stay with Jesus, we know that he's going to win. The devil cannot defeat him no matter how mighty his army is. Jesus is stronger, and he's always going to win the victory. So those who are with Christ, we're told, are called and chosen and faithful. Called by the gospel, chosen by the Lord, and faithful through obedience to his will. And that's what ensures us the victory. That Lord is calling all of us today. He's choosing us today if we will be faithful. Surrender to his will, give our lives and our hearts to him, that victory will be ours. So if someone here tonight needs to do that, you can by obeying the gospel. Your faith in Jesus motivates repentance from sin, confessing the name of Christ, you're ready to be baptized for the remission of sins, and then to walk that faithful walk so that heaven will be your eternal home. If you've done those initial things and haven't been faithful and need to come back to the Lord so you're on the side of victory and the side of triumph and you can have that home in heaven, repent of wrongs, confess your sins, ask God to forgive. We'll pray with and for you. God will forgive and restore, and heaven can be our eternal home. If you need to do that tonight in a public way, we'll help in any way that we can if you'll come forward as we stand and as we sing.